All right, so this is Bio 241, and it is Monday, August 25th, and we're right in the middle of the chemistry chapter. So if somebody has any questions on chemistry, first, chemistry only. Anybody got questions on chemistry only? No questions. Very good. Very good. Very good. Well, we're going to carry on with that. Maybe you didn't study a lot over the weekend or something, but hopefully you did, because chemistry is strange to a lot of people, unless you started studying chemistry in high school or something. All right, well, I got another announcement, too. I tried to log on to Blackboard a couple minutes ago, and all of my classes have disappeared from Blackboard. So I presume that all your classes have disappeared as well. I don't know when the last time you checked. Before class? Was yours there? You printed it out. Okay, that's fantastic. Well, maybe my classes have come back. I'm not sure. Or maybe they really have disappeared and will come back later today, or maybe they won't come back. I certainly hope they come back, because it'd probably take me about a month or two to get everything back on. So that would be a drag. And then on my online classes, too, I don't know what would happen if those classes went away completely. So the bottom line is, guess what? If there is material on Blackboard that you need for a test, and that test is only a week or so away, don't wait until the night before the test to go get it, because guess what might happen? There could be, what, an internet malfunction, or the server could malfunction, or the program can totally go away. I'm not sure what can happen, right? So if you need information for the next certain period of time, go there and get it sooner rather than later, like the study guide, exam figures, etc., etc. Don't necessarily count on that it will be there at any particular second, okay? So those of you that need a syllabus or lecture notes or things like that, you'll probably have to see me in my office afterwards to get you a syllabus. And as far as I know, there's no availability in this class if you need to add the class. You're certainly welcome to talk to the lab instructor to see if somebody did let them know that they were going to drop, but I don't have any add codes to give people. On WebStar, every once in a while, it looks like there's availability in a class, but sometimes an instructor will give an add code to somebody, but they won't use it right away. So it looks like there's availability in the class when indeed all, you know, the class is full. So check with your lab instructor with that regard. All right, well, let's review just a little bit from last time. The beginning part of chemistry was that we started with an atom. And what are the two places inside of an atom? And what particles exist there? Protons is a particle. Where can it be? In the nucleus. What else is in the nucleus? Neutrons. Give me another name of a particle. Electron. Where can it exist? In an orbital. Give me another particle. Ooh, good trick question. There is no other particle. It's just those three, right? So, all right, so you got to start studying. Make sure you have confidence when you come in to take that test. There's only three particles that you have to know of. And how many places in an atom? Two, the nucleus or in orbitals. And then you learned why different elements are different elements. What is the difference between carbon and hydrogen? The atomic number. Atomic number. That's a good place to start. And what does the atomic number mean? Number of protons in the nucleus. Because an atom can gain or lose electrons, right? So some people say, well, it's the number of electrons that atom has, but that's not really the best definition, because an atom can gain or lose electrons and become an ion, but it's still the same element, right? And the thing that determines what kind of element it is the number of protons inside the nucleus, which is called atomic number, right? All right, so make sure you have all that on the tip of your tongue, because that explains different chemical bonds. What are four chemical bonds that we have to know about? And I think maybe you know about three. The strongest. What's the strongest? Covalent. What's the best way to describe a covalent bond? What's happening? Yeah, valence electrons are shared. What about ionic bonds? Yeah, the valence electrons somehow are donated or accepted by different atoms. And so those atoms then gain or lose a charge, and they become ions, and then ions of opposite charge attract each other, and that forms the basis of that ionic bond. And then lastly, we talked about one of the weakest, which is the hydrogen bond. As a result of hydrogen bonding covalently to either an oxygen or a sulfur or a phosphorus atom, those atoms pull electrons away from the hydrogen and just leaves that one naked proton sitting out in space. So if you look at that molecule from that direction, it looks like it has a positive charge. So even though water, if you look at it from far away, overall it's neutral, but if you look at it up close, depending on what angle you look at it, it either looks like it has a little positive charge or negative charge. And so water is what we call a polar molecule because of that polar covalent bond that it has with the oxygen. All right, and then the weakest of all the bonds. I'm not sure we talked about that. I don't think it's in your slides, but it's not a hydrogen bond. It's not between polar groups and molecules or ions. It's between nonpolar groups, and it's called van der Waals forces. Van der Waals. And van der Waals forces are the weakest kinds of forces. And you'll see where this plays a role maybe a little bit later in this chapter, but it's between nonpolar groups and maybe the same molecule or different molecules. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure that you really even know what I'm talking about just yet when I say nonpolar interaction. Because let's talk about a polar interaction. On the slide that we have right here, I have a bunch of molecules. What kind of molecules do I have on this slide? Okay, oxygen would be, for instance, an atom. Let me see if I can turn one of these lights off. That's not bad. Let's try that. If it's still too bright, I'll turn it down. Well, what is H2O? Water molecule. So I have a bunch of water molecules right here. And water molecules are polar, meaning what? These hydrogens right here, kind of positive in that area. And this area right here of the oxygen is a little negative. That means that this molecule is polar in nature electrically. And when we put a bunch of water together, even though it's a liquid, it still displays a lot of structure. Even liquid water has a lot of structure. Water is almost like a liquid crystal. And the reason why that is because, see another water molecule right here? And another water molecule, and another one, and another one? Can you pick that out now? Okay, so these solid lines represent covalent bonds, and you could actually build that covalent bond if you wanted to, knowing orbital theory. But this dotted line right here is a hydrogen bond. That's a weak one. So this positive charge of this first water molecule is going to want to associate with this negative end of the next water molecule. That's what we call a hydrogen bond. It's a weak association, but it is there. So all water is ordered like that. It has an order to it. And the next one is lined up like this, and the next one like this. So there's a lot of structure even in liquid water. And that explains why some insects can even walk on water. Maybe who's seen that? Who's ever seen an insect like walking on water? And you might wonder, well, how come that insect just doesn't fall right into that liquid? And that's because of hydrogen bonds between all the molecules of water. Something has to be heavy enough to break these hydrogen bonds to go kaplunk into the water per se. Okay. So that association right on the surface of the water, for all these water molecules, we call that surface tension. So another question I could ask you is water, if you're going to pick between one of these two concepts, is water sticky or is it slippery? What would you say? You would have to say, indeed, it is sticky because of hydrogen bonds. It's not really slippery. Of course, if there's water on the linoleum down over here, you're going to slip on it. But essentially, water molecules like to stick together, and that produces surface tension. That has some important physiological implications later on in the class for a number of different reasons. There's parts of your body where we would like that surface tension. There's other parts of your body where that surface tension has to be defeated. And we'll learn about how your body uses surface tension or defeats surface tension when it's a disadvantage in a certain part of your body. Okay, so water is definitely sticky. So the previous slide, all right, we're still talking, let's go even to the previous slide. So that these water molecules have two ends, right? So here we have a sodium atom. And what can you tell me about this sodium atom right here? Describe that sodium atom for me. What is it? It has a positive charge, so it is an what? It's an ion, or you could say it's an electrolyte because it's an important particle in our bodies that helps determine the electrical properties of our body. But exactly what kind of ion is it? It's a cation because it has a positive charge. Furthermore, you could tell me even something else about that cation. Okay, it's a monovalent cation because it only has a plus one charge. Right? If it had two plus charges, it would be a what? A divalent cation. If it had two minus charges, what would it be? A divalent anion, right? Yeah, anion. So make sure you understand that terminology. Those are really easy questions on a test, right? So that just kind of tests your skills of memorizing. That's not a difficult concept at all. All right, so here you have that monovalent cation, which is sodium ion. And where did this extra electron from sodium, where did it go? It was donated to chlorine over here, so this chlorine is a monovalent anion. But anyway, getting back to the sodium right here, since it is positively charged, what end of the water molecule wants to associate with it? The oxygen, right? Negative charges attract each other in terms of electrical charges. So we said that water is highly structured, very ordered, and indeed even when we put sodium chloride in water, right, it dissolves very easily because sodium ion and chloride ion will dissolve in any polar solvent very easily because of their charges. Right, so the negative charge of the water will want to associate with the plus charge of that sodium ion. And so it's a very nice association. Those charges have a tendency to cancel out, and salt dissolves in water very easily because it is a polar solvent. Okay, so hydrophilic molecules are soluble in water. Hydro meaning water, philic meaning the love of, right? So that just means that if it's a water-loving molecule, it can be soluble in water. And why the heck is that? What kind of molecule is water? Is it polar in nature or nonpolar? It's polar in nature. So any other kind of molecule that has polarity associated with it in terms of those electrical charges will dissolve in water. But if we have a molecule that's completely nonpolar, then it's going to be just completely disinterested in dissolving in water. It just won't dissolve in it because it has no interest in being around a polar molecule. And those are what we call hydrophobic molecules, or nonpolar. They cannot form hydration spheres. And could you maybe give me an example of a molecule, a kind of molecule that just does not dissolve in water? Like oil won't. Oil, gasoline, those are all nonpolar compounds. No matter how you look at them, they don't have any kind of electrical charge on them one way or the other, so that when they are next to water, they just don't even recognize it. They just have no interest in mixing with water because there's nothing similar about those two kinds of molecules. All right, and we'll see that we can actually break our planet up, and we can break ourselves up in these two major domains, and it has really important implications, whether it's a polar molecule or a nonpolar molecule. We can infer all kinds of information about their activity, where they go, what kind of effects they have, and how it controls our physiology by their basic nature as being polar or nonpolar or hydrophilic or hydrophobic in nature. And it all has to do with the charge on the molecule. All right, who's got a question on polarity at all? Okay, just don't forget, in the back of your mind, just try to remember van der Waals forces. This is an interaction between molecules that are nonpolar. They're hydrophobic. And since they're hydrophobic, they like to associate with each other, and that's the weakest of the weakest bonds. So before we move on, let's order the strength of bonds, starting with the strongest. What's that?
Covalent.
What's the next strongest? Ionic. And what's the next strongest? Hydrogen. And then what's the weakest? Van der Waals forces are the weakest. That's right. Okay. So we're going to put all kinds of molecules together in our body with these various kinds of bonds. All right, acids, bases, and the pH scale. Let's talk about that for a second. Some of you might be kind of aware of this. All right, I'm going to use some terminology in class. So let's draw I'm going to draw something on the board. All right, so here is a proton. What's the charge on a proton? Plus one, right? So I'm going to put a plus one right here. And I'm going to put this in the nucleus of something. And then in the outside, I'm going to put this guy. What's this guy? Electron. Where is that? Right, in an orbital. So this minus one and plus one cancel out, so the overall charge is zero. And what atom is this? Yeah, and you could look at the periodic table, right, to find out that that's a hydrogen because the atomic number is just number one. Well, now let's get rid of this electron. What is that thing right there? What is that thing that's on the board right now? It can be symbolized a little bit differently. It can be symbolized as being H plus, right, because it's only a plus now. What the heck is this thing? It's a monovalent cation. I like that. I like that. But it goes by two other names. Okay, it goes by two other names. Sometimes we call it a proton, because what is it? It's just a proton sitting there. Or sometimes we call it a hydrogen ion. Hydrogen ion. So if you take a hydrogen atom, rip away that electron, you're left with a proton or hydrogen ion. It's the same thing. Okay. All right, so what the heck is an acid? You should probably know that acids are very reactive. If you spill an acid on yourself, it will burn you because it's so chemically active. It's super, super reactive. All right, so an acid is anything that releases protons in a water solution. That means it's a chemical that's a proton donor. It gives it off to the water solution. And what's a proton? It's a hydrogen ion. Right, so an acid is something that donates hydrogen ions to a solution. It's a donor. What the heck is a base? Okay? A base is something that accepts hydrogen ions. It will take hydrogen ions out of a water solution. So it is a proton acceptor or hydrogen ion acceptor. Here are some examples of acids and bases, and some of these are strong acids like hydrochloric acid, HCl. So here is HCl, and it can dissociate into hydrogen ion. It's going to donate hydrogen ions to the water solution, plus what? And chlorine just is a chloride ion, like that. Okay, so the water solution picks up a lot of these guys. Hydrogen ions becomes very reactive. And hydrochloric acid dissociates completely when you put it in water. There is never any HCl left. It breaks down immediately and 100% to hydrogen ions and chloride ions. Phosphoric acid is a pretty strong acid as well. Okay, not as strong as hydrochloric acid. And it can donate a number of protons, not just one, depending on, we'll see what the pH is, nitric acid, sulfuric acid. These aren't so important biologically. Phosphoric acid is real important biologically, as we'll see. And then carbonic acid is also very important for physiology. So sooner or later, you're going to have to be able to memorize this chemical formula right here for carbonic acid, H2CO3. And This sort of looks similar to a molecule you might be familiar with already that we breathe out of our bodies, which is carbon dioxide, CO2, right? So this carbonic acid actually comes from carbon dioxide that our bodies are producing. So these are all acids because they can donate these protons to a water solution. These over here are bases because when you put sodium hydroxide in solution, what do you get? This is a strong base. NaOH is going to break down into sodium plus this thing right here, OH minus. That's called a hydroxide anion. You believe me when I tell you it's an anion? Yeah, because it's what? It's got this negative sign right here. It's a hydroxide. And so these things dissolve very easily in water because they're polar substances. Plus, what else can happen? What happens if we were to combine this thing and this thing here? Say we put both hydrochloric acid and sodium hydroxide in water, what would happen to each other? If you add an acid to a base, they neutralize each other, right? That's one nice way of neutralizing an acid is with a base, or if you have a base, you want to neutralize it with an acid. And if you mix them in just the right amount so that they're equal, what do you get out of it? H2O, you just get water out of it. And therefore, that's a nice neutral solution. Okay. So NaOH is a base because when we put it in water, it produces these hydroxide anions. And what does it do? It looks around for hydrogen ions and it neutralizes them. So, right, we call that a proton acceptor. A base is a proton acceptor because it's going to accept a proton that's in solution and neutralize it. That's what a base is. Okay. On one of the previous slides, right here, you see that we can have a water molecule and it can be broken down into a, what's this guy here called? Hydrogen ion, or sometimes we call it a proton. We use those terms interchangeably. Proton sounds weird until you use it a couple times. And then also this hydroxide anion. Water can just automatically break down. Depending on the pH, we will have different amounts of these two substances, either protons or hydroxide ions in solution, depending on the pH. And that's what I want to show you right now, I believe. Okay. Okay, so pH is a symbol for the concentration of hydrogen ions in a water solution. And it's got to be a water solution. It doesn't make sense to measure the pH of gasoline because it's now water. Gasoline and water will never mix. It's got to be some kind of aqueous solution. All right, so the pH scale runs from 0 to 14, and it's calculated with this equation right here. And if you're familiar with a calculator and you want to try some of these things out, you can. But I'm not going to ask you to know how to work this particular equation right here. But a lot of students always ask, how do you come up with these weird numbers for pH? Well, here's how you do it. You put in the hydrogen ion concentration in scientific notation, right? And then take the inverse of it and then the log base 10, that would be the pH. And in pure water, we say it is neutral. It has a pH of 7. And so if we put 1 times 10 to the minus 7th right here, that would be the concentration of hydrogen ions right here, that would be equal to a pH of 7. And that would mean if it's neutral, all right, if it's a neutral pH, here's a good kind of thought question. So if it's neutral, and we're talking about this thing right here, what's this thing again? It's a proton or hydrogen ion. And if the concentration is 1 times 10 to the minus 7th, and you don't know what that means, but that's just the concentration. Okay? And I'm saying that this is neutral. When the solution is neutral, how many hydroxide ions are in there? When the solution is neutral, Okay, what is the concentration compared to the number of protons? If it's neutral, they have to be what? Exactly equal. So what would be the hydroxide ion concentration at pH 7? Would be 1 times 10 to the minus 7th molar 2. All right? They would be exactly equal. This is a really small number. What number is that? That's 0.123457. It's a really small, it's not a negative number, it's just a really tiny number, right? Okay. So when it's neutral, the hydrogen ion and the hydroxide ion concentration is exactly the same, and that's at pH 7. Okay. As soon as you get more hydrogen ions in solution, you think it becomes more basic or more acidic? Becomes more acidic. That means that that number goes from 10 to the minus 7th to what? 10 to the minus 6, right? 10 to the minus 5. It's the number's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. As the concentration gets higher and higher and higher, then the pH here would be 6. The pH here would be 5 according to that equation. So that shows you something interesting and initially fairly confusing to students, because as the pH becomes more acidic, what happens? Oh, as the solution becomes more acidic, what happens to the pH number? As it becomes more acidic, the pH number actually gets smaller. It goes from 7 to 6 to 5 to 4, all the way to 1, actually to 0, right? And so when a pH is 1, it is what? Very acidic. Very, very acidic. So as the pH, let's work this with my thumb, make sure I say it right. As the pH number goes down, what happens to the acidity? Goes up. Another way of saying that, as the pH number goes down, what happens to the hydrogen ion concentration? The hydrogen ion concentration goes up, because this is a bigger number, right? So the pH number goes in the opposite sense that the hydrogen ion concentration goes in. Furthermore, if the hydrogen ion concentration gets even smaller, what's smaller than 10 times to the minus 10 to the minus 7th? What about 10 to the minus 8? What's the pH here? 8. Less hydrogen ions, less acidic, or you could say what? More basic. It's more basic. Okay. So on this little cheat sheet that we have right here, it gives you the range of some of these things. Pure water has a pH of 7, equal concentrations of hydrogen ions and hydroxide ions. Acids have a pH less than 7, like from 0 to 7. And bases have a pH greater than 7, 7 to 14. And you can't get less than 0, you can't get more than 14. So our blood, anybody know what the pH of our blood is? About 7.35. All right, so our blood is what? Is it neutral? Not neutral, kind of close. It is what? Actually, it's basic. It's greater than 7. It's basic. It's greater than 7. Okay. So just to make sure, I don't know, maybe you guys are real familiar with this, but let's take a beaker like this and so I'm going to put 3 beakers up here with 3 different water solutions in them. And you should be able to tell me which one is acidic. Which one is acidic? 1, 2, or 3? 3. Has more hydrogen ions than hydroxide. Which one's neutral? 1. The number of hydrogen ions equals the number of hydroxide ions. Which one's basic? The one that has more hydroxide ions in it. Right? So that's really all that kind of means. Okay. All right, so that's pH. So don't forget, as the hydrogen ions in solution increase, what happens to acidity? Okay, yeah, I'm glad we're thinking about this. Okay, let's reset our mind a little bit, and you might have to look at the beaker. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases in water, what happens to acidity? Okay, I'll tell you, because you're just on a little bit of a wrong track for a second. As the hydrogen ion concentration increases, the acidity increases, but what about the pH number? But the pH number is the one that goes opposite, right? The pH number decreases. So you got to be able to think about those things, right? And who knows how that question could be worded on an exam. So you got to have that straight. If it's not straight in your mind, if you're really confused about that, you got to see me or do something. Or what could you do? SI Leader has answers for that kind of stuff, right? Okay. So probably if I were in your shoes, I would probably go to the SI sessions sooner rather than later, right? Before the first test. I know a lot of students will be really interested after the first test, but maybe you should start going before the first test, okay? Okay. All right, so here you see a pH scale. So this right here is concentration, molar concentration of 1 mole per liter versus 1 times 10 to the minus 14th moles per liter of what? Hydrogen ions. So this is a really small concentration. So is this acidic or basic? 10 to the minus 14 is basic because there's hardly any hydrogen ions there in solution. That's pH 14. All right, and when it's 10, what is the number 10 to the 0? 0 of power. That's just a little mathematical trick that we learn in math. What's that? That's equal to the number 1. You can punch that into your calculator. So okay, well, I'm sorry. That shows it right here, but I'm not going to show you why that shows it, okay? Okay. So notice only when at pH 7 is the concentration of hydroxide and hydrogen ions the same, right? Okay. That's what neutrality means. Okay. Another concept is that of a buffer. Now, you're probably familiar with this blood pH right here. Now, how drastically can that change? Or should it change very much in your body? Maybe I'm going to drink a big Coke from 7-Eleven. The pH of Coke is pretty close to 1, which means it's what? Acidic. So if I drink this quart of acid, what's going to happen to the pH of my body? You think that it should become very acidic, right? Well, what would happen if this pH were to drop from 7.35 to maybe 7.2 right after I drank that Coke? It would become more acidic. I'd die. I'd croak. But so that doesn't happen. Why does that not happen? Because of chemicals in your body that we call buffers. And buffers are compounds that resist a change in pH no matter if an acid or a base is added to solution. So you can add an acid or you can add a base, it doesn't matter, but the pH is not going to change. That's a different kind of concept than saying a buffer neutralizes acids. That's not really true. A buffer will do what? It will stop a pH change if an acid or a base is added. And there are some real important buffer systems in our body. All proteins are buffers, and our bodies are made of a lot of proteins. And one of the most important, not maybe the most important, but one real important one, is the bicarbonate buffer system. Right? Because when acid is added to a solution, okay, it's going to combine with bicarbonate. It's going to produce carbonic acid, which then is going to produce CO2 and water. And we can just breathe the CO2 right out of our body whenever we eat a lot of acid. Now, where was acid here? Right here. That's from the Coca-Cola. Now, these symbols right here should be arrows. I don't know how it shows up on your slides, but PowerPoint can't handle symbols very well. So those things should be a double-sided arrow. That means it could go one way or it could go the other way. Okay, how does it show up in your PowerPoint slides? Like that. Okay, just like that. So put some arrows in there that go back and forth. That means it's freely reversible, can go one way or the other. Okay. So this buffer's pH because the reaction go to either direction depending on the concentration of hydrogen ions. Okay, so blood pH is in this range right here. Acidosis is when the pH is less than 7.35. Alkalosis is when the blood pH is greater than 7.45. And people's pHs can't change very rapidly over a short period of time, but it can change beyond these limits if you're given enough time to compensate for that. It still signifies a disease process in your body, maybe like diabetes or something like that, but you can still stay alive for a period of time. Okay, so that's pH and some buffers. Organic molecules. Let's talk about some important kinds of molecules in our body. Organic molecules. And an organic molecule is one that contains both a carbon and a hydrogen with some kind of covalent bond. So it's a covalently bonded hydrogen to a carbon atom is an organic molecule. And not all organic molecules are important biologically, right? But a lot of biological molecules are organic. So I could give you some molecules on the board, and you could tell me if it's organic or inorganic, or if it's important biologically. What about H2O? Is that important biologically? Absolutely. Is it an organic molecule? No. It's inorganic. Probably the most important molecule in your body is an inorganic molecule, which is water. All right, what about carbon dioxide? Is that an organic molecule? It's got a carbon, but what else does it have to have? A hydrogen. Do you see hydrogen? Nope. Is it organic or inorganic? Inorganic. Your body produces it. Your body's a little factory that's producing this stuff all the time. That's not even an organic compound, but it is real important biologically. What about, did I show you how to look at this molecule? Maybe not. What about this molecule here? It's got a carbon. Oops, sorry. I'll put a parenthesis here. It's got a carbon. It's got an oxygen. And what else? Hydrogen. Right? Is this an organic molecule? Yeah, because an organic molecule has got to have carbon and hydrogen. So indeed, this is an organic molecule. And in particular, that's one of the major kinds of molecules we're going to look at, because what is this thing right here? And how is it easily recognized? What do you see? You see carbon and what's H2O? Water. This used to be called carbon hydrate, but today we just call it carbohydrate. What's that carbohydrate? That's a sugar. So this is just a chemical form for sugar, which is carbon hydrate. And for instance, glucose is when you would have 6 carbons, 12 oxygens, and 6 carbons, 12 hydrogens, and 6 oxygens. That would be glucose. So this N right here for glucose would be what? Would be a 6, because you'd multiply this number by each of these atoms right there. So, you know, glucose is a carbohydrate or a sugar, and that's just a general formula for sugar, and that is an organic molecule. Okay, so those are organic molecules. So some are important biologically, but there are many inorganic molecules that are important biologically as well. Like what? Water. What about this one right here? Organic or inorganic? What is it? Carbon monoxide. Anybody hear that? It's what? It's a very deadly poison from internal combustion of some kind of fuel. It's a poison because it poisons your red blood cells, so you can't carry oxygen in your body. And you suffocate. Even though you can breathe in and out, you can't carry oxygen, and you suffocate to death. That is an inorganic molecule. So your body doesn't produce it, but you should still know about it a little bit. Okay. Organic molecules, got to have a carbon with some hydrogen on them. In the body, these most of your important molecules are chains of carbon atoms, like you see a chain of carbon atoms right here. And this is a nice simple molecule, it's very long. And on that backbone, what atom do you see on this molecule right here? It's only hydrogen. So this is one of the simplest kinds of molecules. It's not really important biologically, but it is organic. We call that hexane. And so some of these positions right here that are occupied by hydrogens can be occupied by other kinds of what we call functional groups, maybe a sulfur, for instance, or an OH or things like that. But when we have a nice long carbon backbone like this, it can bend back on itself and form a covalent bond to form this ring structure. So we see a lot of ring structures in biology. So this would be cyclohexane, for instance. All right, and here's another just modification of cyclohexane. This is what we call benzene. So it's just a ring structure, and we have some double bonds between the various kinds of carbon. So on this carbon right here, you only see one hydrogen compared to how many do you see on this carbon right here? You see two. So here a hydrogen is lost, but that means that there's an extra electron that can be shared. So we have a double bond in this location instead of just a single bond. Okay, these are not important biologically, but this is just some of the basic structure of organic molecules. So we can have a carbon backbone in important biological molecules, and instead of a hydrogen, in this location right here, we can have a double bonded oxygen. Okay, so that would be a carbonyl group. Carbonyl. We can have a hydroxyl group. Oh, let me say something further. Let me go back to the previous slide. This molecule right here, no matter how you look at it, never exhibits any polarity. It never has a partial charge or an electrical charge on the molecule. So what kind of molecule is this? Is this polar or nonpolar? It's nonpolar. So if it's nonpolar, is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic. It just doesn't want to have anything to do with water whatsoever because it has no positive charge to associate with the charges on water. Okay. When we look at some of these functional groups, okay, now some of these become polar in nature. Right? So some of these modified carbon chains can dissolve in water because of these functional groups. Plus it also gives them other kind of chemistry that we're going to look at. So here is a carbonyl group. Here's a hydroxyl group, and here's a sulfhydryl group. Amino group is when we have a nitrogen with two hydrogens right here. All right. A carboxyl group on the end, if we have a CO2 and an H, that's a carboxyl group. And that's real important because this hydrogen can disassociate from this long chain, and when it does, it becomes, an acid. So a carboxyl group means that that biological molecule becomes an acid. It can donate that proton to a solution. And then we're left with an O negative, and that means that this is a hydrophilic molecule. Will dissolve in water. Here is a phosphate group. So PO4. Here's a phosphate with four, what are these things? Those are oxygen atoms. This is real important because, again, these hydrogen ions can jump off, and when they jump off, that leaves this end of the molecule very what? Yeah, very negative. And if this end of the molecule is negative, will it have a tendency to dissolve in water or not dissolve in water? It will be ionic. Any kind of ion will dissolve in water because they are all hydrophilic substances. So it will convert this molecule from being completely hydrophobic to hydrophilic because of these positive charges, negative charges on these oxygens right here. Okay. So look this over. Next time we're going to work with some of these in class. All right, make sure you know these different functional groups by name. Carbonyl, hydroxyl, sulfhydryl, amino, carboxyl, and phosphate group. These are going to be all important in our understanding of physiology. Stereoisomers, I don't think I'll ever test you on this, but molecules can exist in a couple different forms. All right, just like your hand. Here's my right hand. I've got another hand that looks very similar to this over here. But are they exactly the same? They're opposite each other, right? It's handedness. So we call those stereoisomers. There are chemicals that can exist like this, but there can be also another form that exists like that. And they're not really, they look really similar, but they're what? They're not really the same in shape. They're not really the same shape. And only, okay, the L stereoisomers, okay, oh, the enzymes of all cells can use only the L amino acids and the D sugars. They can't use either one. All right, but that's all I'm going to say about stereoisomers in this class. Okay. So what are the four basic kinds of biological molecules in our body? We've got carbohydrates, that's number one. Proteins, lipids, and nucleic acids. So we're going to see some differences and some similarities between these different molecules. Okay, so first, carbohydrates. What's the general form for a carbohydrate? CH2O, carbon hydrate. And these are indeed organic molecules. So this one right here, how many carbons are in this one? One, two, three, four, five, six. So this is a six carbon sugar, and when it's put together just in this fashion with an OH over here and then a couple, three OHs over on this side of the molecule, this is glucose. And just like any long backbone of carbon like this, it can form a ring structure. So a lot of times glucose is symbolized by this ring structure right here. So it is a linear molecule, but it can fold back on itself. And this is what we call a monosaccharide. This is just one standalone carbon unit. Down over here would be an example of galactose. Notice that the OH in different positions you will find on the other side of the molecule. So there can be many different kinds of six carbon sugars or six carbon monosaccharides in our body. Here are two important ones, glucose and galactose. And again, galactose can form this ring structure. And instead of having this double-bonded oxygen on the last carbon, it can be on the second to the last carbon right over here, but it is still, how many carbon sugar is this? It's still a six. This is what we call fructose. It forms just a little bit of a different ring structure. Okay, but this is fructose. This is what we find in a lot of sugars from plants, from fruits and things like that. So we call that fructose. So these right here are all monosaccharides of the six carbon variety. And this is what many carbohydrates or polysaccharides are made of in our body, these monosaccharides. So you probably all knew that a protein, what's a building block of a protein? Amino acid. But for a polysaccharide, the building block is going to be a monosaccharide, and here are a couple examples of monosaccharides. And we can put them together much in the same way that we can put amino acids together to make a protein. But if we put monosaccharides together, we don't get a protein, we get either a disaccharide if there's two monosaccharides put together, a trisaccharide, or if there's thousands of monosaccharides put together, we call it a polysaccharide. But they're all carbohydrates. Right, they're all carbohydrates or sugars. Okay, so a disaccharide has two monosaccharides joined together covalently by a covalent bond. What kind of bond is a covalent bond? Weak or strong?
Strong.
It's strong. That's right. It's a strong bond. Okay, some examples. Sucrose, that's table sugar. Right, that's what we dig out with the spoon, and that's a disaccharide. It's got one glucose and one fructose put together. That's what we call sucrose. Lactose, or milk sugar, is one glucose and one galactose put together. So it's a disaccharide as well. And maltose is two glucoses put together. So we can come up with different sugars that have different tastes, different chemical properties, depending on what monosaccharides we put together. Okay. A polysaccharide has what? Many, many monosaccharides put together. And a polysaccharide might be made up of thousands of monosaccharides. So what kind of molecule is that in terms of its size? is huge. Actually, it's humongous, right? If we put 1,000 of these monosaccharides together. But what is it a storage? What is it storing? It's storing energy, because what it's really storing are what? It's a source of monosaccharides. It's storing monosaccharides, and glucose is a very important energy form in our body, which we're going to see in one of the next chapters. Okay, so there are two kinds of these huge storage forms of glucose in particular. Not any other kind of monosaccharide, but glucose in particular. These include starch and glycogen, and you're probably familiar with starch. Can anybody tell me a food that has a lot of starch in it? Potatoes, wheat, bread, for instance, right? Anything that's made out of flour has a starch in it. And so when you eat starch, what are you really eating? It's like a candy bar, right? Because it's just made of glucose. So it's just a big polysaccharide. It's just sugar. So somebody that's a diabetic has to be really concerned about their consumption of bread, potatoes, or starch, pasta from wheat. It's just one big, huge molecule with thousands and thousands of glucoses on it. Then there's another kind of molecule called glycogen. Right, starch, well, I tell you what, starch. Where do you find starch? It is only found in plants. Glycogen is a very similar kind of compound, but you don't find it in plants. You find it in animals, namely us. We store glucose in the form of glycogen, not starch. If we eat starch, we can digest it. Right? And then if we have a lot of it in our bodies might convert it into glycogen, which is very similar. So glycogen is just what we call animal starch. The branching pattern is a little bit different. So it stores energy, right? Glycogen allows organisms, and starch, allows organisms to store thousands of glucoses in one molecule, all right, which drastically reduces osmotic problems. So we'll talk about osmosis and osmotic issues in one of the next chapters, not in this chapter. Okay, but it's a convenient storage form of glucose. So how does our body do that? All right, well, here we see two monosaccharides, a glucose and a glucose. And I see that little plus sign right there. That means that we're going to add them together. So those are really two independent molecules, and we're going to join them. Well, this is something I think will be very interesting to you. The way it is joined covalently, you see a C H2O right here. So we have an OH group, and then on this end of the other glucose we have what? A carbon. We don't write the carbon out every time because it would be too cumbersome, but there's a carbon atom right here, and bound to it is what? An H2O. All right, so when we join these molecules together, what's highlighted in yellow right here is what? H2O. So if we pull this water molecule out, we can form a nice covalent bond right here. So here you see just an oxygen in between these two monosaccharides. And what's been pulled out? A water. And that water now joins the water in your body. So that's really interesting, because not only is water a solvent that our whole body is dissolved in, but it participates in almost every chemical reaction in your body. So it's kind of just incredible how evolution has worked to make that so. So when water is pulled out of a chemical reaction like this, we call this a dehydration synthesis reaction, because what are we doing? We are synthesizing a new compound, namely maltose, and we call it dehydration because we're pulling a water molecule out. So this is an example of a dehydration synthesis reaction, and some people call it condensation reaction. You probably have to be a little bit more chemical oriented to say condensation. More biologically oriented people would say dehydration synthesis reaction. And for instance, if we wanted to make sucrose, what are the building blocks of sucrose? Two monosaccharides, one would be glucose and one would be fructose. And guess what kind of chemical reaction your body uses to make a sucrose from glucose and fructose? A dehydration synthesis reaction. This reaction is used over and over and over and over and over again. So it seems like the chemical reactions in your body are very complicated. But essentially, when evolution has figured out a chemical process that works well, then right? It's employed by various systems in your body. So dehydration synthesis is a very important kind of reaction. Guess how you put a couple amino acids together? Even though you haven't studied it, it would be a dehydration synthesis reaction. So let's look and see how that happens eventually in one of the slides. Okay. All right, so that's how we make a more complex sugar from its basic building blocks. So if you want to make a glycogen, what would we do? We would just keep adding these glucoses together via dehydration synthesis reactions all the time, pulling a water molecule out. And if you wanted, for some reason, to break glycogen down, you can perform the reverse reaction with a different enzyme, because what does your body have plenty of? Water to break those bonds. Okay. So let's see, what do we have here? Do I have the reverse? I don't have the reverse right here. But digestion of a polysaccharide, right, if we go in the opposite direction right here, instead of a dehydration synthesis reaction, we're using water. This water gets broken apart and inserted into this location. So now we have two separate monosaccharides. We call that a hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis is going the opposite way from dehydration synthesis. So, for instance, when in your body you have a glycogen molecule, when your blood glucose level starts to drop and your liver wants to get glucose from someplace, it goes to glycogen in your body and it chops off one glucose molecule, puts it in your blood, increases your blood sugar levels. What kind of reaction is taking place in your liver to increase your blood glucose level when it's chopping glycogen down into its basic building blocks? That would be a hydrolysis reaction. Okay, putting sugar into your blood, releasing monosaccharides. Okay, lipids, another important biomolecule. So for each one of these, I would like you to know that it's a class of chemicals and also the building blocks. So the building block of a polysaccharide is just monosaccharide. And a good example of a monosaccharide would be glucose or fructose or galactose. Those are three maybe that we've talked about. Now, I'm not going to ask you to recognize this thing right here as being glucose or galactose or fructose. Right, I just would like for you to see a structure like this, or maybe even like this, and say, oh, well, that's a monosaccharide. But the specific monosaccharide, you won't have to tell me what it is. We're not interested in that kind of detail in the class. Or what stereoisomer it is. That's not really important in this class. All right, so lipids. I don't know if anybody can tell me what the basic building block of a lipid is, but that's one of the things that I would like for you to know. Okay, so let's take a look at lipids. Now, lipids as a class of hormones, are what we call, for instance, if you get, what about butter? Is butter a lipid? Yeah, butter's a lipid. You get butter on your clothes first thing in the morning because you're making some toast and it fell on your pants, like butter side down as it always does. Can you get a wet paper towel and just kind of clean it up? No. Because lipids won't mix with water, because lipids are essentially hydrophobic in nature. They have no charges, have no electrical charge on them one way or the other. Okay. Carbohydrates, on the other hand, if you take sucrose and you put it in your coffee, will it dissolve in water? Absolutely. A lot of it will, because it's what? It is a hydrophilic substance. It's full of polar bonds, so it will dissolve in water very easily. All right, so let's go to lipids. They are insoluble in polar solvents. What's your favorite polar solvent? Water. I'm glad to hear that. Because I always have somebody smart that says alcohol in class. It is a polar solvent, but it should not be your favorite one. Okay. Okay, so lipids are what we call hydrophobic because they have no charge associated with them. They consist primarily of hydrocarbon chains and rings. No functional groups on them whatsoever. That's the basic form of a lipid. All right, so here's a slide that shows a couple different kinds of lipids. This one right here This long backbone of carbon right here is completely hydrophobic. We see a little functional group, a carboxylic acid right here. So this one has a little bit of a hydrophilic nature. These things, because of this acid group, this carboxylic group right here, we call these fatty acids. These are fatty acids. And how many do you see right here? One, two, three. There's three of them. Okay. And we can join these together by using a molecule that kind of looks like a sugar molecule. We call this glycerol. It's not quite a sugar. It's a cross between an alcohol and a sugar. But if we put these three fatty acids together with glycerol, and glycerol has a three-carbon backbone, and look what can happen. This OH on glycerol can combine with this one hydrogen from the carboxylic group. What do you got? H2O. The second fatty acid can bind the same way to the middle carbon, and then a third fatty acid can bind to the last carbon on this glycerol and form this compound right here that has now three fatty acids joined to that glycerol molecule. So when you put three fatty acids on a glycerol, what's the resulting compound? It's called a tri, because of these three fatty acids in glycerol, it's called a triglyceride. It's called a triglyceride. So a triglyceride is really a storage form of these fatty acids right here. A triglyceride. Who's ever heard of a triglyceride? Maybe, because we do blood tests for these things all the time as a marker for cardiovascular disease or lipid metabolism inside somebody's body. So triglycerides are measured all the time. Now, how did we make this triglyceride from these three fatty acids and glycerol? What kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis reaction. You see that water coming out? Here's a water coming out. One, two, three. Right? So now we just have this carbon-oxygen-carbon bond right here, and we're left with three water molecules. All right, so again, it's a very easy kind of chemical reaction to appreciate that's used over and over and over and over and over again. All right, so what is the building block of a triglyceride? Three fatty acids and three fatty acids and glycerol. Right, three fatty acids and glycerol. And one glycerol. Three fatty acids and one glycerol, to be precise. That's really good. Okay, that's a lipid. There are other kinds of lipids in our body, but you know, a fatty acid is a lipid by itself because it's hydrophobic. Another kind of lipid, maybe it's not on the next slide, but for instance, if we have a triglyceride and we want to break it down into fatty acids and glycerol, what kind of reaction would we use? A hydrolysis reaction, just like we did for glycogen, breaking glycogen down into glucose molecules. A hydrolysis reaction. Maybe do I have this on the next slide? Not quite. Okay. Here's a quick slide that shows a big long, what does this look like? A big hydrocarbon chain with a carboxyl functional group on the end. This is what we would call this right here is a fatty, and this is an acid part of that fat. This is a fatty acid. So here is, how many carbon is this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 12, 13, 14, 15. So a 15 carbon unit fatty acid is what we call palmitic acid. And if it has a different carbon number, then it's given a different name. Okay? Does anybody know a name of another kind of fatty acid like linoleic acid, has a different number of carbons in it, right? So depending on the carbon length, it's just given a different name. So if you're a biochemist, you would know all the different fatty acids by their carbon length and name. Not so important in here, but you should at least remember that this is a fatty acid, okay, because of this carboxyl group and this big long chain right here is that hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's phobic because it has no charges on it whatsoever. Okay, this one right here is what we call a saturated fatty acid. And it's called a saturated fatty acid because on every carbon atom, there are two hydrogens bonded to it. So two independent covalent bonds to hydrogen. Same for this one. Same for every carbon in this backbone. An unsaturated fatty acid is when we pull off a hydrogen and we're left with an extra electron, We pull off this hydrogen and we're left with an extra electron. So now we're going to form another bond between these two carbon atoms right here. So instead of a single bond, we're going to have a double bond right there. So because some of the hydrogens are pulled off, we call that an unsaturated fatty acid. Saturated just means it's saturated with what? Hydrogen atoms on every carbon. You can't put any more on there. Okay? An unsaturated fatty acid. So that's the big difference between saturated and unsaturated fatty acids. I'm going to tell you the next slide in passing. Sometimes, well, we know that a lot of energy is stored in fats, and sometimes energy can be released from these fatty acids by breaking them down. All right, and some of the breakdown products are these compounds right here, acetone and acetoacetic acid. And your body can produce ATP under certain circumstances if those fatty acids are broken down. So these we call ketone bodies. And later on in the class, I'm going to refer to ketone bodies, so this will make a little bit more sense. But at least you will have heard of the term ketone body before. And ketone, where do ketone bodies come from? From fatty acids. The way that we metabolize fatty acids is at two carbons at a time. Break it down two carbons at a time. And then another part of your body will add those fragments together, okay, to make a ketone body. That's a favorite way of trying to make ATP when sugars are not available for you. Okay. All right, so here is another exam figure, a phospholipid. All right, so let's take a look at this molecule right here. Why do we call this a lipid? Well, let's focus our attention on this part of the molecule first. You got 1, 2, 3 carbons with an O and an O and an O right here. What does that kind of remind you of? A three-carbon molecule. It participated in forming a triglyceride. What was that? That was glycerol. So in your mind, can you see this thing right here kind of looking like this thing right here? 1, 2, 3. That's what I would like for you to see from that slide. All right, so let's go back. All right, so furthermore, look at this right here. That should remind you of a fatty acid. This should remind you of another fatty acid. So far, this kind of looks like the usual kind of triglyceride with a glycerol backbone and two fatty acids. But let's look at this last carbon position right here. What's on this one? We see a phosphate group. The last position on this glycerol is a phosphate. And then there's this fancy amino group right over here, a nitrogen-containing group. And this phosphate group, all right, I tell you what, let's go back over here. These fatty acids right here, this region, is it hydrophilic or hydrophobic? It's hydrophobic because that's the lipid part of the molecule. But now let's look at this phosphate group. Look at the phosphate group. It's got this minus sign. That means that it's what? It's hydrophilic. So here is an interesting molecule that has what? Two of those natures that are not mixable necessarily. So a phospholipid molecule, and also look at this nitrogen group. It's got a positive electrical charge right here again. So this end of the molecule likes to dissolve in water. Here's one part of a molecule that does not like to dissolve in water. So it's an interesting kind of molecule because it has both natures simultaneously. It is both hydrophilic and hydrophobic at the same time. And we're going to see what this means in terms of the building of life. Right? It's actually quite amazing. So instead of drawing the diagram with all of these chemical elements and atoms, we can draw it diagrammatically by the two different natures that it has. We can draw it with this big sphere and two long legs sticking out. So these long legs right here correspond to what? The fatty acids that are hydrophobic in nature, don't want to have anything to do with water. And this guy right here is filled with all these charges. This is the hydrophilic part of the molecule that wants to dissolve in water. So this molecule is a lipid, but we call it a phospholipid. And the interesting thing about a phospholipid is that what will it like to do? Dissolve in water only? Or lipid only? Or maybe both. Maybe both. That's right. Okay, so phospholipid is probably one of the most important molecules in the establishment of life as we know it. Okay, because, let's take a look at this. And this is an exam figure, so you should know a phospholipid, turn it upside down, be able to recognize it. So, let's take a look at that molecule for just a little bit more. And let's start with a, what does that look like to you? That's a salad dressing bottle. Okay? And we got salad dressing in there. And you know, what about salad dressing? If you get it out of the refrigerator, what does it look like? It's got two parts to it, right? So if it's filled up to the top, there's still another layer right here. So there's something down here and something up over here. What's up in this top compartment? This is the oil part because it's less dense. It goes to the top. And down over here is the water. All right, so down in the water you got what? Salt, spices, all the kind of tasty stuff. So when you pour salad dressing on your salad, you just pour, you take it out of the refrigerator and pour it on your salad? No, because you just get oil, right? So you shake it up first, right? And then you put it back in the refrigerator, and what happens to that salad dressing bottle when you come back the next day? Is it still all shook up? It is separated out, kind of by magic. Did you do anything to get that to separate? No, it just happens automatically. And it happens automatically because this is what? This is hydrophobic part, and this is the hydrophilic part. That just happens because of physical chemistry, all by itself. Nothing magical there. Okay. Well, oops, let me do it this way. So we still have our salad dressing bottle right here. And this is oil. And here's water. And now we're going to take our phospholipid. I've made it a billion times bigger than it really is, right? Here's a phospholipid. And we're going to pour a bunch of phospholipid into this salad dressing bottle. And where's it going to go? Is it going to go in the oil? Or is it going to go in the water? Yeah, it's going to go half and half. How so? Because this phosphate group right here is what?
Hydrophilic.
It's hydrophilic. I'm just going to abbreviate. Hydrophilic, and this part here is the phobic part. So if we stick these molecules in here, where are they going to end up? How about like that? You believe me? That's pretty good. I figured it out. Sometimes I get it backwards. But that's true. It's going to go just like that. And is there anything that we did to put that molecule or all these thousands of molecules right here on this meniscus between the oil and the water? Did we have to do anything special? Automatically happens. That's pretty amazing. And I tell you what, if we put a bunch of these molecules in here, guess what we really are making automatically? This thing is what we call a membrane. And all biological membranes really look like that. So the bottom line that I'm trying to tell you is membranes have the ability to self-assemble themselves, to build themselves automatically out of what? Non-living kinds of molecules, depending on the nature of how they like to dissolve in water or not dissolve in water. So it's actually kind of amazing. So let's erase this salad dressing bottle and let's just put water. Let's just put water and... Here's a bottle with here's something with just 100% water. And that would be kind of a good approximation of what? Pretty good approximation of you, right? You're just a bottle with water and some other stuff. All right, but now let's put in some of these phospholipids. What are phospholipids going to do in you or this bottle right here? Well, this hydrophobic region does not have a hydrophobic region anywhere in here at all. It has no place to go. But if it finds another molecule of a phospholipid, what does it find? Another hydrophobic region. So what assembles in this particular case is this polar head group here, and another one here. Pointing in this direction are the hydrophobic regions. Oh, did I say phobic here? These are hydrophilic head groups. Look at that. All of the hydrophobic tails are now associating with each other because why? They don't want to have anything to do with water. This is what we call a micelle, but what does it really look like now? It kind of looks like a cell. So cells even have that property of self-assembly. Even by using these non-living molecules, we can build cells by just throwing them in water and they will build themselves automatically. Okay, that's pretty cool. So I think you have a slide. Not as good as my diagram, but right here, okay, this slide. And you can see all the hydrophobic tails of those fatty acids poking into the center of the micelle and these hydrophilic head groups that have charges on them want to associate with water because water is polar, just like the phosphate head group is polar. Okay, so you can see the beginning of a cell because this is just a nice membrane now. Okay, we're going to talk about surfactants later on in the class. Okay, so a phospholipid is a special kind of lipid. It's got two fatty acids, but on that third position of glycerol, it's got the phosphate group and that nitrogen group. The last kind of, almost the last kind of lipid is what we call a steroid. And a steroid is always going to be formed of these four ring structures, 1, 2, 3, 4, and it kind of looks like a staircase, right? You step up here, and step up over here. And I want you to be able to recognize these structures as being steroids. And I don't care for you to know that one is estradiol and another is testosterone and another is cortisone. Okay, that's not so important. I just want you to be able to recognize that basic structure right here as being a steroid. We'll work on that probably next time in class. And here's cholesterol. Is cholesterol a good thing or a bad thing in your body? Okay, you guys are aware of that. It's good and bad. If you have too much, it's bad because it produces cardiovascular disease. But it's necessary for a number of reasons because, look, estradiol here and testosterone are metabolites of cholesterol. That means cholesterol is a precursor to sex hormones and other hormones that regulate things in your body like cortisone. So you got to have just the right amount, but not too much. Cholesterol will also be incorporated into membranes to give them stability. So it's an important component of some membranes. Prostaglandins are basically a fatty acid. So here's that carboxyl group that's folded back on itself in the very middle. And prostaglandins are very important hormones in your body. They're built from fatty acids. All right, so that's the last kind of biological molecule. Well, we didn't finish the chapter today. So we got to go on to proteins and nucleic acids next time. But I think we can finish that up pretty fast.